Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. We're late again. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. This is the House Committee on Revenue, and it's about 1:40, not quite. And we are gathered today. This is the 18th of May, and we have a number of bills before us. We're going to start off with a public hearing on Senate Bill 283. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 283. And ask Mary to come forward and tell us about Senate Bill 283. I understand we're waiting for some amendments on House Bill 2234, which is our last item up today. We may not yet be able to have that, and that was the one that was called back off before last week.
Senate Bill 283 enables a limited liability company to qualify for a property tax exemption or special assessment if the LLC is wholly owned by one or more nonprofit corporations, and the property would qualify for exemption for special assessment if directly owned by a nonprofit corporation. It applies to tax years beginning in 2006. Okay. Background on this particular bill is that under current law, some types of nonprofit corporations qualify for a property tax exemption. However, others do not. The public benefit nonprofit corporations must report to the Department of Justice. This year, 12,000 public benefit nonprofit corporations reported to the DOJ. However, there were over 17,000 nonprofit corporations that filed reports with the Department of Revenue. The difference represents religious nonprofit corporations and mutual benefit nonprofit corporations. Local tax assessors were given data to review, and they were asked to consider whether they were aware of any recent cases in which a major nonprofit benefit corporation owned an LLC that was denied a property tax exemption that would have been exempt had the parent corporation retained its ownership of that property. None were aware of such cases. And that basically sums up the original amendment, which had no revenue impact, Mr. Chair. We also have an amendment, the Dash 1 amendment, which adds on, since the relating clause deals with taxation.
Mary?
I'm sorry. Yes?
Just a moment.
I'm sorry.
The Dash 1 amendment?
Yes, I have a Dash 1 amendment.
Why don't we go ahead and have it distributed at this time?
Okay. Since the relating clause on the original bill just dealt with taxation, there was an amendment requested, and we've added it, and it doesn't deal particularly with limited liability corporations, but it does pertain. It pertains to a residency requirement for long-term care facilities. Basically, on the amendment, which the amended version is the original bill plus this additional reference to long-term care facilities. These facilities currently, there are about six of them that have received a property tax exemption of roughly $100,000 per year. That's the estimated tax loss as reported in the Department of Revenue's expenditure report. These entities, long-term facilities, care facilities, qualify for this type of property tax exemption on real and personal property if they satisfy certain residency requirements. And right now, the residency requirement for a long-term care facility is 70% if residents, or I should say 70% of the residents must be eligible for Medicaid. And the proposal is to drop that requirement to 50% effective July 1, 2005. You'll notice that the original bill had an effective date for 2006, and the amended portion has an proposed effective date of July 1, 2005.
Thank you, Mary. Colleagues, as was mentioned by staff, Senate Bill 283 has a broad relating clause relating to taxation. And consequently, we've got, I think, three total requests for amendments in this bill at this particular point, in one way or another. And so what I'd like to do is I'd like to invite Ian Richardson forward from the Oregon State Bar Tax Section. And I think you're original bill without any amendments, so let's get started on that, and we'll talk about the proposed amendment before us today.
Okay, thank you, Chair Butler and members of the committee. Thanks for having me here today. My name is Ian Richardson. I'm a lawyer from Eugene, and I'm a member of the Oregon State Bar Taxation Section. I'm here as a representative of the Taxation Section of the State Bar. And I'm here to urge you to pass SB 283, and I've got two reasons why I think you should do so. Number one, this would give a significant benefit to charitable organizations currently owning or operating real property in the state of Oregon. The limited liability company, since its inception 10 or 12 years ago in Oregon, has become the entity business organization of choice for holding real property. And I think that's pretty widely recognized. And the benefits of limited liability companies are largely their flexibility, or a combination of their flexibility, with the limited liability shield that is not available other than via corporations without the limited liability company. So it is something that private landowners use every day. And further, the IRS has recognized the utility of using this sort of a limited liability company owned by charity, and in 2001 the IRS recognized that this sort of an LLC would be recognized as a tax-exempt organization and would not be subject to income tax. So those are I think that's the upside of this bill, is it allows charitable organizations to run their affairs as private individuals would, and as charitable organizations in some other states already can. The second reason why you should pass this, I think, is that there's no downside. And I've heard that there's a concern that this may cost money. This may be a revenue issue, and I have trouble seeing that. Currently, I think that the state or municipalities and counties receive no property tax from charitable corporations that own real property that are used in their charitable purposes. But I've heard there may be one exception in Portland that may be the reason why I'm here today, but I'm not sure about that. I think right now this is a zero revenue source. If you don't pass this bill, you won't change current law, and you will continue to receive no revenue from charitable organizations that own real estate for their charitable purposes. And if you pass this bill, you will receive no revenue from those charitable organizations. I think it's a net zero sum on the revenue side. And I think it's as simple as that, really, and I'd be happy to take any questions from the chair or members of the committee.
Well, Ian, I'm not an attorney, but let me just take a gander at this. Because the LLC was the vehicle of choice for holding and trying to have the corporate veil over these kinds of ownerships, corporations were actually taking, or have been taking, or could take under this change, title in the name of an LLC to property, which otherwise wouldn't be taxable, but it just would provide an additional corporate or an additional shield for the other assets of the charitable entity. Is that what we're saying then?
Yeah, an additional shield in an alternative form. Currently, for example, the common 501c3 organization would form a sub-corporation, a 501c2 or 501c25 corporation, and I guess to be blunt, that's a bit of trouble. You have to requalify that corporation as a tax-exempt entity with IRS, et cetera. It takes months and costs a fair amount of money to do that. An LLC is a very easy solution to the same problem.
Okay. And so what this basically does at that particular point is it would give a nonprofit an opportunity to form several different LLCs holding different properties in different LLCs, so that if they're sued on one property, they don't lose the properties that are held in the other LLCs.
I think that's right.
Okay.
And we see that all the time with private corporations.
Sure. Yeah. Sure. Nothing wrong with it. I just wanted to make sure I understood it. Mm-hmm. Questions of Mr. Richardson? Yes, Representative Boakley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to clarify, the LLC, of course, is a wholly owned subsidiary of a 501c. Does then the LLC will have to report annually to the Department of Justice? Is that correct? And I don't really remember the. I know it's a 990 right. Form. It's got to be copied and done too. But I'm trying to see how is the public going to know, or how is someone going to know the LLC is wholly owned? And is there a yearly reporting requirement?
Yeah, it's a good question. I'm not sure that the Department of Justice has thought about it. They could do it one of two ways. When you file an income tax return for the wholly owned LLC subsidiary, it does not file a separate return. Everything shows up on the return of the parent entity. You could take that approach and basically report the LLC's activities through its parent company, or you could have it report separately. I suppose there may be a need for some mechanism by which the Attorney General's office would be able to recognize, or Department of Justice would be able to recognize this.
Follow up, Representative.
So then, I guess, and it's a Form 990 that they have to file. So I'm assuming that the LLC, I don't know for sure, that the LLC would have to be listed on the Form 990 that's filed with the IRS, of course, a copy of which has to be filed with the Department of Justice for the annual report for the 501C. So the only question I would have is, you know, if the LLC has to file separately, then maybe you start running into how many of these do you envision? I mean, to get an idea of what the fiscal.
Well, you could have a separate one of these LLCs for every parcel of real estate that's owned by that would be qualify for the tax exemption. I don't know whether that. I don't think that would be the case immediately, but. I guess I'd suggest that this is the kind of thing that the Department of Justice is or Attorney General's office is capable of handling from a mechanical point of view. And are you concerned that this is going to substantially increase the number of filings that they have to deal with? I don't think it won't change the amount of information that's passing to them.
Let's see. We do have information indicating there are 12,000 public benefit nonprofit corporations reporting presently to the Department of Justice. Do we know whether that includes the LLCs that Representative Boquist is asking about, or are those just the 501c3s or other Oregon nonprofit corporations?
I assume that is the total number of nonprofit corporations qualified in Oregon. I don't know how many of them own real property.
The 17,000 nonprofit corporations that filed reports with the Department of Revenue, which would be similar to your 990, I'm assuming.
Right.
Okay.
We'll follow up, I'm sure.
Okay. Yes, Representative Lopez.
I guess a better way to address this is from, I guess, your private practice. I mean, how many people are knocking on your door saying they want to do this?
Well, actually, we have been. Thanks for the question. I've become involved with this because we have a number of of charitable corporations who are clients, including some of the larger foundations in the state, who are interested in doing this. And they're not willing to take the risk at the moment, and the alternative is not perfect. It works. It is currently working. We use these corporation subsidiaries, or we simply hold it in the main entity. But we would far prefer to be able to form a simple, easy-to-manage subsidiary that will isolate the charity from potential risk. The primary risk in board of directors' minds is environmental, usually. And there's a little detail to this. I don't know whether it's particularly interesting, but there is no method that I'm aware of currently to get that real property to the charity without it passing through the charity's own hands. Therefore, the charity has to put its name in the chain of title and is therefore potentially subject to environmental claims. An LLC would allow that to have that property to pass without the title ever being held in the name of the company, the charitable corporation.
To follow up, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this may be straying far afield here, but in you're looking at environmental risk, reducing environmental risk. It would seem to me that you would be reducing debtor or bankruptcy risk too, because even though they're wholly owned subsidiaries, they are separate properties and separate entities. That's your fault.
They are separate entities. I guess I'm not sure what you mean by the bankruptcy risk or creditor.
Yes, please.
Say hypothetically, and we'll use hypothetically, and you'll recognize this right off the bat. Let's say you have a large religious organization, 501c of some sort, and it has subsidiaries, and if each of their real estate properties underneath had LLCs like this, what is the legal impact across the board here? Are we therefore allowing them to because they form a limited liability and put, you know, one property from maybe Sheridan or one property from Salem, they're all each, and they have their own board of directors underneath them. Does this sort of function then limit the financial risk to the parent?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. That's the idea.
So really what could happen here is that people could actually contribute property to their favorite charity, the real property, that might otherwise have brownfield site on it that would clobber everything up, and could do so through that LLC, and eventually would still receive the charitable mm-hmm. contribution, too.
Yeah, I think that's right, Mr. Chairman. I don't know whether it could be quantified, but I think that it may indeed motivate some charitable giving of real property.
Okay. All right. Further questions? Well, thank you very much,
Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, thank you.
Now, there's an amendment proposed, and Jim Carlson, you have that amendment. Would you come forward, please? And that's the dash one amendment. And it's been passed out. The dash one has been passed out.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jim Carlson, representing the Oregon Healthcare Association. I'm here this afternoon to speak in favor of the bill and specifically to the Dash 1 amendments. We had an issue that arose after the start of the session, actually with one of Representative Dallum's constituents, a small rural assisted living facility in Jefferson County, who had historically over the last number of years qualified under the existing law for a essential community provider property tax exemption in Jefferson County. The statute currently defined an essential community provider as one who had 70% or more Medicaid census during the previous tax year. This particular facility fell a couple percent. They missed it by literally just a couple of patient days on meeting that threshold. And we got engaged and involved in some discussions actually with the county council at that point and then actually with legislative council to see if the county still had the authority on their own motion to go ahead and grant the exemption even without a statutory change. The response came back from legislative council that it would take a legislative fix to address this issue. So at that point, we started working with Representative Dallum and started looking for vehicles, of which this was the only one with the proper relating clause. We then met with the sponsors of this bill, the Oregon State Bar. We then once had and met with Chair Butler and others, met with other taxing districts or taxing entities who may have an issue, Oregon Special Districts Association. We circulated the amendment out to the League of Counties, League of Cities, to make sure folks were comfortable with this legislative fix, and we did get sign-off on that from those parties. So basically what you've got in this amendment is a pretty simple change that changes the current threshold from a 70% to a 50%, but it's important to note that this is only on the own motion of a taxing district. So any tax district to opt in to grant these exemptions for a taxpayer in that taxing district, it would take adoption of an ordinance or a resolution by that taxing district to grant the exemption, or they are not encumbered in any way from making any amendments or changes to any existing ordinance or resolution that's currently out there. And so this has primarily been a tool that has been used on a fairly limited basis by smaller rural counties trying to provide some assistance to some essential community providers to try to make sure they have access to a service in that small service area in that community. And so that's what you have before you this afternoon, and I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Questions of Mr. Carlson? Yes, Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just curious why it was set at 70% in the past. What was the point of the 70%?
Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, back in 99, I did have a hand in lobbying through the original legislation. There was no magic to the 70%. There was no magic to the number. At the time, we had to work through this whole issue with local taxing districts and others who didn't know how widespread the potential utilization of this would be or not. And at the time, there was a policy decision made to set the bar a little higher. What we've seen since then on the experience is we've had about, I don't know if it's a half dozen counties. I know your staff mentioned six providers who are currently receiving the exemption. It's been one that we had a number of smaller counties opt into and pass ordinances. This is not something that exactly caught fire in what I'll call urban and suburban counties. And so at this point, since it is still within their control at any of these taxing districts level on whether they grant the exemption or not grant the exemption, we decided on going for the legislative fix to, if we moved it to 60% and someone came in at 59 or we had the same issue, we decided to provide more leeway and allow this to be kind of more of a local decision.
Follow up.
Follow up, please.
If it's a local decision, why do we have a percentage at all?
Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, I mean, basically, that may be a very valid question. We basically, in working with legislative counsel on trying to address the specific issue here on this one, just made a decision to just drop it to 50%. I can tell you by practice, in rural communities, it's a struggle for folks to remain financially viable in these smaller communities if you have a high Medicaid census. And anytime any facility, even in an urban, suburban area, gets to a point of 50%, Medicaid census, it becomes a bit of a challenge. And so the only magic to that 50% number is that's kind of a threshold in terms of where the difference of a $50,000 to $100,000 a year property tax exemption could make the difference between whether a facility is viable or not viable.
One final
follow-up.
Yes. What happens at 49?
Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, we'd be back in the boat we're in now in terms of looking to make a fix. I would tell you in all honesty that if you start falling below 50% Medicaid census, while it's substantial and Medicaid rates generally are not nearly what private pay are, generally facilities with at least half or more of their revenue coming from private pay resources generally have enough of a private pay base where they can be a little bit more of a captain of their own destiny, so to speak. Whereas once you start getting 50% or more Medicaid, you're pretty much dependent on what the state rates are, and whether you're going to be viable or not, it's going to really depend on what your state funding levels are at.
Thank you.
Further questions for Jim? Thank you very much, Jim. Appreciate it.
Thank you for the opportunity today.
Any further discussion on 283? If not, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 283. As I said, colleagues, there are a number of people that want to tack on to this bill because of its relating clause, and I'm anxious to open that headgate open. So I'm going to just go ahead for the time being and hold this bill in advance. So we'll close the public hearing on 283, open the public hearing on Senate Bill 29. Representative Westland, Senator Westland, thank you for your patience. Mary, you want to just tell us quickly what this is?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. Thank you. The bill clarifies that a property's real market value, not some other type of value such as assessed value, will be multiplied by the changed percent ratio in order to determine the property's maximum assessed value. As you know, when property is new or improved, the tax assessor has to come out and place a value on that, and it can't be at real market value. Based on current law, it has to go in and take the change percent ratio, which is the average assessed value for, let's say, a county relative to real market value, and multiply that times the real market value of the individual property or improvement. That formula will get you to an estimate, which is the assessed value of the property that will be taxable.
Thank you. Senator Westland, thank you very much for coming forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Senator Ben Westland, District 27, and I am honored to be called representative in your presence in front of my old mates that I miss so much. Mr. Chair, I appreciate your hearing Senate Bill 29, which in truth is a housekeeping bill that corrects a wording vagueness that in actuality has never resulted in an assessed value error in the past, and if one reads ORS 308156 in its entirety, will probably never result in an error in the future. However, words are important, so I have prepared 2 hours of riveting testimony that explains why changing the word value in the aforesaid ORS to the phrase real market value would result in no revenue or fiscal impact, and in truth simply clarifies what has been a long-standing practice but could result in an error in the future. I would be happy to stop here before I make the other hour and 57 minutes of my presentation and answer any questions, or continue if you would like, Mr. Chair.
Well, is that either that or our colleagues could probably join you in your office for the other hour and 7 minutes. Questions for Senator Westland? It sounds like the 3 minutes version was as good as the hour and 57 minutes more. So.
Probably much better, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
I would encourage discussion and fixing this technical fix. But other than that, I appreciate you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
You do realize if we'd have been on the Senate side, we would have had that hour and 57 minutes more.
No, we wouldn't have. Actually, we would have started 2 hours later. There's no further discussion. We'll go ahead and close public hearing on Senate Bill 29. I'll open a work session. Let's see. Yes. We get the potential for work session. We'll open work session on Senate Bill 29.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Berger?
I move Senate Bill 29 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
You've heard the motion. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection to the motion? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered. And we have all members present for the record.
Consent calendar.
Representative Berger now moves Senate Bill 29 to the consent calendar. Is there any objection?
There was one no vote on that.
There was Senator Schrader on the Senate side.
Doesn't matter. Just raising. I'm not going to object.
Okay.
To raise that.
Hearing no objection to this being moved to our consent calendar. So ordered. Thank you. So that will be on the consent calendar. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 29. We'll open a. We're scheduled for a work session on House Memorial 7. We'll open a work session on House Memorial 7. Let's see. And Elizabeth. We've had one previous public hearing on this.
Chairman Butler and committee members of House Memorial 7, we heard this once on the 12th of May. It is expressing support by the Oregon House of Representatives to Congress and the President of the United States to permanently abolish the federal estate tax. It acknowledges the hardships that businesses face paying the tax, as well as hardships families face if businesses have to close and employees lose their jobs in order to pay the federal estate tax. It provides that copies of this memorial shall be sent to the President of the United States and to each member of the Oregon Congressional Delegation. Again, we've discussed quite a bit about the federal legislation and that basically by will be a complete elimination of the federal estate tax effective 2010, but just for 1 year. So under current federal law, then beginning tax year 2011 and beyond, the estate tax would be reinstated on all estates with gross value above $1 million. So this is addressing that issue and the uncertainty there is under current law. And so, again, with Oregon, you are connected to the 1997 law. So any changes that are going to be taken in Congress, we would not automatically connect to. We would need additional legislation here in Oregon in order to connect with those. And just so you have an understanding of how much estate tax is paid at the federal level here in Oregon, in fiscal year 2004, Oregonians paid $245 million in federal estate tax. It represented roughly 1% of the total U.S. federal estate tax collected of $24 billion. And in 2004, the federal estate tax collected comprised just around 1.1% of all federal tax collections.
So if I understand this correctly, then that it would actually take an affirmative change in Oregon law to make any changes beyond the 2010 date. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes.
And right now, 2010, we've moved back to the $1 million gross estate valuation.
Right. But,
and,
but we're not connected with that. Yeah, it's federal.
And we're not connected with that.
Yeah, we're connected with the 97 law, and we will be at $1 million in 2006.
Okay. And then with regard to the basis adjustment after 2010, property accelerated basis as it passes through the state and Oregon.
Yeah, so we would be collecting additional revenue, but that under current law. When we go back to the $1 million, then you have the step up in the basis.
We would have the step up in basis, or we wouldn't?
No, we would not, because okay, it's
we
not.
Would,
yeah,
we would not have step
because at the federal level they're not.
Right. Okay. Okay, colleagues, you've heard the discussion. We are in work session. Further discussion relative to House Memorial 7.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Hass.
Well, I just am saddened that we're taking time out to deal with this issue. For starters, I mean, I don't even know where to begin, but we've already dealt with the estate tax in this chamber at the appropriate venue, which is the state government. And secondly, some of the statements in this bill are just so far from reality that, you know, farmers face, businesses face losing their businesses, and this is particularly harmful to families who are working, and it's just filled with non-factual sort of propaganda that I just don't think it has any place in the Oregon legislature. And to be honest with you, I just think there are a lot better things we can be doing with our time, especially in this committee, when we have so many other state pressing problems, than to send a letter to Congress that's full of propaganda that I think some of us here would very much disagree with, strongly disagree with.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Comp is recognized.
I think I figured out my question. I kept reading the bill, so thank
you. Okay. I guess I would look at it and say if there was a way to keep $245 million of federal estate tax from going to Washington, D.C., that might be a benefit to the state of Oregon's economy. But that would just be my opinion in that regard. Further comments, Representative Galizio?
Yeah, I had a couple concerns. One is the use of the phrase death tax, and I don't think that's the proper term to use. It's a spin doctor sort of term. I mean, why not, maybe we could put vulture tax or grim reaper tax if we wanted to get even more creative, but the phrase death tax, to use that is to celebrate sort of political operatives and spin. And if that's what we want to do, I guess that's what people are going to vote.
Well, I think lines 6 and 7 refer to the fact that under ACRA it was the federal estate tax, commonly called the death tax. That's still what it's commonly called.
Commonly called in some circles, but with a political purpose. But specifically also lines 12 and 13. It says, the tax is particularly harmful to families who are working to achieve financial stability and accumulate wealth and capital for the first time. So I guess my question is, somehow old wealth or the economic aristocracy in the United States are not part of folks who pay the estate tax? In other words, should we call it the nouveau riche tax? Because according to the way this is phrased, it's only people who are accumulating wealth and capital for the first time. But the reality is, this is good for folks like the Paris Hilton estate. So it's a lot of old wealth are the people who are going to benefit. So I guess I don't understand why we have lines 12 and 13.
Well, I guess my response to that, Representative Galizio, would be that I suppose I would look to some of those families who have generated the old wealth and ask the question how much death tax, federal death tax, they are paying presently. Probably very little death tax. I'm going to guess most of that is estate planned away, and by and large, that they have their own charitable foundations. We see them when we watch public TV and enjoy the public TV as a result of contributions that are made through much of these family foundations that are run by the successive generations. So, I, in my experience, the death taxes which have been paid by my clients is not old line family wealth death tax. It has been death tax that has been paid by people whose farms and small businesses just get out from underneath them with regard to the value, and they've ended up paying substantial amounts of death tax, and in many cases have in fact liquidated. virtually at the at if you were to go to Southern Niagara County, most of those ranches have traded hands over the last numbers of years, basically because of deaths, and not always because of a death tax, but because the family is unable to meet their other obligations following a death with the other incumbent costs. So,
but isn't that, that's not unique to this particular tax? I mean, to make the argument that the wealthiest figure out ways to avoid tax, it's not unique to the estate tax.
Well,
anyway,
I guess that addresses the issue of the first-time accumulation family that you had mentioned, the families accumulating wealth for the first time. Representative Lucio, right. please follow up.
No, I mean, I just would echo what Representative Hass said. I just don't know, after we've already passed in this House, I thought there was an attempt for bipartisanship, and I just see this as really an act that is just sort of push in the faces of those who disagree with this vehemently, and I think it's problematic.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Hass.
Just to follow on that, I guess I would just ask the other colleagues on this committee, is this really a bill that we want to have an acrimonious floor session over?
Well, and no bill has to be acrimonious, but this is a memorial to make a statement to Congress on behalf of the House of Representatives. It doesn't even go to the Senate, so. Further discussion? Representative Boquist.
Mr. Chair, just for the record and the board, just recall that we did review the Washington Supreme Court legal opinion when we were discussing this debate before, and for the record, they did call it the best.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, colleagues, we're in work session. The chair now moves House Memorial 7 to the floor of the House with a due pass recommendation, and we will discuss that. Any discussion on the motion? You're welcome to vote this the way you want. I'm not here to tell you how you've got to vote on this. If there's no further discussion, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Boquist.
Yes.
Representative Esquivel.
Aye.
Representative Felicio.
No.
Representative Trump.
No.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Riley.
No.
Vice Chair Berger.
Aye.
Vice Chair Hess.
No.
Chair Butler.
Butler votes yes. House Memorial 7, having received the requisite constitutional votes in committee, has passed the House floor with a due pass recommendation. With that, we will close House Memorial 7. Representative Boquist, you carried the death tax. Did you ever carry on the House floor the last time?
Thank you.
Thank you. Last item of business, House Bill 2234. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2234.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The amendment that's being passed out to you is a correction that should be replace the dash 5, the B5 amendment. The analysis is correct, but a word has been changed so that the analysis is consistent with the B7 amendment. This bill has been reviewed several times. It went to the floor, as you know, and unfortunately it did not have the correct revenue impact sheet that was passed out and approved during the work session that we had here. So that is the B engrossed bill removed the existing restriction on the number of electronic enterprise zones that can be located within existing enterprise zones. It extends the deadline from December 31st, 2006 to June 30th, 2009 for applicants to obtain required certification for property tax exemptions and corporate tax credits. Creates a two-year time period beginning July 1, 2007 and ending July 30th, 2009, during which time proposed limitation is removed on the number of electronic zones that may be created. The issues we've discussed, and the members had passed this to the floor, of course, and it came back for the reason I just discussed. The dash, we'll go through them in order, I guess. The dash 7, the B7 amendment, and those of you that see B5 up there, make that a B7 in order to conform with the new amendment.
Where are you at on that?
B7. It said B5, but Dexter's revised amendment says B7, so we need to just replace.
So change B5 to B7. That's under date of 5/17. At 3:25 p.m.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So pull the B5 amendment and replace it with the B7. And this is essentially, there's an added issue attached to the B-engrossed bill. It will extend the deadline. The effect of the amendment is that the The B7 amendment allows the extension of the income tax credit to qualified zones located in e-commerce zones, six e-commerce zones, beginning 2006. As you know, right now the current law won't go into effect until 2007, where there's to be no limitations on the number of zones that could be created. But this amendment will allow, for this one-year period, an additional six commerce zones, e-commerce zones, to be designated beginning 2006. Then in 2007, we'd go back to the B-engrossed version, which removes the limitations on the number of e-commerce zones that could be created. Of course, they all have to coincide and be located within existing enterprise zones. Okay. Because of that one minor change, there will be an additional revenue impact because you've got six zones potentially that could start up claiming credits in earlier than the B-engrossed bill suggested. And so if you look at the revenue impact on that bill, it's been changed slightly so that now instead of having a corporate income tax FY05-07 zero impact, it now has a $780,000 impact. Yes, $700.78 million. The rest of the, and then in 2007, all the other impact would be identical to the B-engrossed bill. Okay. If you'd like me to continue,
corporate income tax is still limited. Mm-hmm. It's based upon the amount of electronic investments, that is investments in capital and equipment and two projects, e-commerce projects, within the enterprise zone. And it's limited to 25% of the amount of that investment. Is that right? When you've got a $780,000 item, you're really talking about a $3+ million investment in capital and equipment in the e-commerce zone.
Projected based on the algorithm that I used to originally spread out the distribution of those credits over the five-year period and the assumptions that we used initially on what we thought would occur when you remove the limitations completely. Right. I just factored it down by the percentage that I thought would occur if you opened that up to six
and
more.
And so for the 07-09, the $9 million cost would then equal $36 million of qualified capital investments in the e-commerce zones for those folks that would be qualifying. Now, that's the total impact to the state corporate income tax?
Correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay. All right. Now, that means that those folks are going to have a profit in order to use that because the credit is not, if it's not used, it's a carryover, as I recall.
Is correct, Mr. Chair.
What is it, a carryover, 5 years?
5 years.
Well, Mr. Chair, what I did was create a kind of a simulation with two different sets of assumptions. One set said, these companies will be able to take the full credit, let's say, in the first two or three years. The other said, let's suppose they don't have enough to take the full credit because their tax liability is less than, is too small. So then they distribute it over the five-year period at a smaller percentage per year. The assumption is that over the 5 years, they'll be able to take the full credit. That's an assumption. Okay, and so it's distributed differently. And then what I did is I took basically the average of the two to say, here's what, you know, I can estimate.
Okay, the property tax, I need to look at the property tax. The property tax, that's the full amount of the property tax that is now for the value of the property, both personal and real, for 0709. 0507 is none. Why is...
The numbers were so minimal and the estimates were so very soft to begin mm-hmm. with that I didn't want to just... I thought it was more than covered by the estimates that I had.
Okay, so zero personal property tax, or personal real property tax
right.
in 0507, and yet these folks have got profits equal to something in the vicinity of in excess of $3 million. But they would have no property tax?
Well, we could create some simulation that's relatively minor.
Okay. I'm just trying to get a grasp for what it is that we're discussing here. Representative Riley is recognized.
My understanding, if I don't misunderstand this, is that the property tax exemption is under the enterprise zone, and there's no additional property tax exemption under the e-commerce zone. Is that correct?
Under the e-commerce zone, I believe the property tax exemption is at a lower threshold, and so it's very, very minor. They would have that exemption anyway if they were just in the enterprise zone,
mm-hmm.
okay, because they get everything over $50,000 is already exempt, ignoring whether it's an e-commerce designation. All you have to be is located in an enterprise zone. So the real impact for this bill is the corporate income tax credit, which only exists for the e-commerce zones,
right.
And that's
okay.
why the emphasis is on that.
Okay, and so then the $1.06 million in 0709, that's 100% of the property tax, both that portion which is under the 10 mils for the local tax and the 5 mils under the state school.
Correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay. So then roughly 600,000 of that, 600,000 or 700,000 of that is local property tax. The remaining portion would be
correct.
From the state school.
Correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Or education portion of it. Okay. Continue, please. Were you done?
Yes,
okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Berger?
Mr. Chair, if I may ask, what exactly is the purpose of this amendment, this moving it up?
We'll have some folks come and testify on that here in a moment. All I've got to do is just get the sheet and see who signed up, and then we'll do that.
Someone
will bring that forward to us. There was another question asked on the floor, and there's no preclusion for these people for these entities, these companies, to have. There's no preclusion for them that they couldn't have operations outside the United States. Oh, that's right. Work session. Okay, thank you. We do have the maker of the -7 amendments. We'll bring her forward. So tell me about the concern that was expressed on the floor relative to the workers in foreign countries that might be working for these same companies. That was an expressed concern. This doesn't benefit them. Or cause them a detriment, does it, if they choose to have overseas operations and still have an enterprise zone?
I can't address that.
Okay. Okay.
It's not addressed.
We'll come back to that issue because I would like to have a better feel why we had some colleagues that were concerned about those that might have overseas operations. I can tell you this, if you want to limit all credits to folks that only have Oregon enterprises, then we will never have a chance at any international business here.
The credit is only on that portion that is in the enterprise zone.
Correct.
Right. There's
correct.
No credit for anything that exists outside the enterprise zone.
I was going to say, right, I mean, if you look outside the state, you could own something else.
Even some property in the state, which is not in the enterprise zone, is not subject to this.
Correct.
Okay.
I think our colleague from the Corvallis area was concerned they could have operations and call centers in India, and there's no preclusion from that happening here. Representative Esquivel, I think you've gone from the last time we met. We had 11 of these facilities statewide, one in Roseburg and 10 in Medford in your home district. I think you may have an update as to how many you now have.
Well, there's 34 in the state now, and of those, 32 are in Medford. We have capital investment of almost $80 million, and over the progression of this, we have created or retained 4,813 jobs within the enterprise and e-commerce overlay. So it's been very successful.
Representative Berger?
Mr. Chair, if I could inquire, that's the entire enterprise zone, not just the e-commerce piece?
It's the e-commerce piece in the
only
enterprise.
The
you cannot put an e-commerce overlay unless it's in an enterprise zone.
I know,
so
they
have to go hand
in
hand.
My question is, the figures you gave me are for...
Just for e-commerce.
Just for e-commerce.
Right. And I guess the difference is we're not selling a secret. We're letting it be well known that we have this available, and it's a very good tool, and we've been quite successful with it.
Have any idea as to the profitability of these companies? They would be taking advantage of the existing law.
Wouldn't know.
And any idea as to the fact that they may have any other foreign states or overseas operations?
Well, probably like you get in some of your call centers, things like this, you probably would. Sure, I would assume so. But it has nothing to do with what we do in the e-commerce overlay.
Could it enhance your e-commerce overlay?
I assume it would. I assume the only thing that it would is enhance it is if they're paying taxes elsewhere or not paying taxes elsewhere, whatever they're doing elsewhere, if it's a more of an affordable situation to put capital investment within an overlay, then they would so do so.
Okay.
Whereas it just boils down to a business decision at that point.
And the point is to get them to bring those to this zone instead of overseas.
Yeah.
But I think the big thing here is the $80 million of capital investment.
In the community, yeah. Not to mention the 4,000 plus jobs. Representative Hess?
I've always been concerned about this part of it, but Representative Gerard brought it up on the floor, and that is whenever you add new enterprise zones such as this, you are diluting those that already exist. And I'm sensitive to that.
Okay.
True. I was actually soliciting a response.
Yeah, that actually, if I may, Mr. Chair.
Please.
We've been the most successful in the state of Oregon. There is not one in Klamath Falls. I believe they do have the e-commerce overlay, I think. There and Burns, I believe. Yeah.
Burns, North Portland, Northwest Portland, I believe.
Correct.
And Roseburg. And
well, then Klamath is not included?
Klamath is not included for e-commerce.
But they have an enterprise zone.
They certainly have an enterprise zone.
What this does, if I were a real stinker, I'd say, let's kill this thing.
That's what I was going to ask.
But do I believe in that? No. And I'll tell you why I do not, Representative Hass. I was the president of Southern Oregon Regional Economic Development, which was two counties. Did I celebrate when we had business advancements and bring businesses into Josephine County, even though I lived in Jackson County? You bet. Why? Because it's good for the region. It's good for the state. These programs aren't specifically just for Roseburg and Medford and Burns and Northeast Portland. They should be good for the state.
Representative, let's follow up, Representative Hess.
I see it the same way that we should try to benefit the state. And in fact, there are some people who would like to export some jobs from Washington County out to Burns and Ontario and Josephine County or wherever. I think it would be good for the state to have greater employment in Bend, in Burns. And since we have a zone in Burns, by adding more of them in other places, we are taking away that attractiveness and the appeal to locating in Burns. So I just wonder if, you know, I mean, if you look at it on a statewide perspective, that's my fear, that we're not helping Burns here by adding more enterprise zones.
Colleagues, you won't get any rise out of Dollar Media at that particular point. I feel very strongly
like
that,
well.
that's probably the right way to approach this. My concern is that if they're going to bunch up in one place of the state, that we need to make sure that everybody has an equal opportunity. But I'm also concerned that if Burns can't get something online very soon, that I don't know what I'm going to do. I've had as much as 30%+ unemployment in Harney County, and that's devastation. And my schools in Harney County are in very, very serious trouble. I mean, they can't cut teachers. I think the list this morning was 5 more teachers and 1 more administrator being cut, and that the schools are dying. And the concern is that if we can't get one of these located in Burns to create a couple of hundred jobs, and we are not talking about $15 or $20 an hour jobs. We're talking about minimum wage or better than minimum wage just to get people to work. So thank you, Representative. Representative Riley, and then Representative Combs.
If I may.
I'm sorry. Okay.
I agree that this waters it down somewhat, but it does still have requirements. It can't be put in high wage districts. It has to be a distressed area. It still has to be inside of an enterprise zone, and enterprise zones have those restrictions.
That's a good comment. Representative Boquist.
Okay, I thought I understood this before it left, so I just want to. I just want to clarify and make sure I understand, Mr. Chair. When we start looking at the revenue impact for property tax and for corporate income tax, and this forecast right here, as of today, there's nobody in these places.
No, there are. This is the additional cost. We're adding on
locations. Is that
yes,
not
we are.
Correct? Mm-hmm. And presently in those locations, there's nobody there. And we're not collecting taxes from them. Because what we're trying to do in your case is we're trying to get people to move to Burns. So that in Burns...
Put that in the form of motion, I'll second it.
You don't need a second. I'm taking Robert's Rules of Order. I screwed up for myself, Mr. Chair. So what we're saying here is we're trying to attract new business to these locations.
Right.
Is that not correct? So if they don't come, we don't gain or lose anything. Is that correct? Because I'm not familiar with this. So yep. What we're trying to do is create the incentive that I guess sure to get them to come to one of the existing ones that's approved or the overlay for these future ones.
And in that regard, Representative, what it is that we're attempting to do with regard to this whole process is to make certain that in the fiscal that we do not lay out something to create businesses a deduction or an advantage or a tax credit that they were going to come to Oregon anyway. I mean, if these folks were already on the way. However, that being said, if they were already on the way, then why aren't they locating in Klamath Falls as opposed to in Medford? Why aren't they locating in Grants Pass, where it's the weather, and
it's the climate. That's what they're
saying. It's the climate. Yeah. That's right. It's not the weather. It's the climate that you're supposed to go to Grants Pass for. They are coming to Oregon, and they're locating in one of these two locations, either Medford or Roseburg at this particular point. And let's face it, these businesses typically are quite incestuous. They love to take from others of their kind and move employees around. If you get a supervisor that's well trained in one of these e-commerce businesses, I'm going to guess that the talents that they generate are probably very handy for the other one that just went to 38th one or 39th or 40th one that just went down the street, and they're saying, and you're making $55,000? What would you do to come for us for 65 or 75 plus some stock options? So what we're trying to do is we're trying to make sure that they're in those locations where they can benefit one another.
Mr. Chair, it used to be that way. I've been in that business for a long, long time. And when I first got in that business, what you described exactly is what happened. But that's changed a whole lot. We don't do that anymore because there aren't that many jobs.
So the managers, the folks that move up to the top that know how to run these things...
There aren't enough jobs to go around. That's why we're doing this. We need more jobs.
Okay. Representative Boquist?
I guess I would add 2 cents. I fully understand what Representative Haas is saying, but, I mean, to try to attract, you know, the capital, the investors, the community they want to live in, there are so many factors that go into this, 5, 10, 15 factors when someone makes the decision to go there that, you know, no disrespect. But, you know, Burns might not be the place, and no disrespect. Klamath Falls might not be the place. So, I mean, some reasonable parameters of having something like this to say we have, okay, you looked at Burns, and no disrespect, I don't want Burns. I mean, maybe one of the lawyers out here wants to move to Burns, but that's fine. But we ought to have alternatives so that we can try and attract them. And, you know, at least then when we attract them here, we'll gain the jobs, whether it's in your district or wherever else it is. And, you know, and again, no disrespect to the areas, but it appears to me that Medford obviously has done a better job of selling this thing and attracting people than the other places have.
And we didn't need it. It's so good up in Washington County, we didn't need it.
Oh, it's...
Okay, we have an amendment before us as well, and I think it's appropriate probably that we discuss that amendment. I'm going to invite Doris Penwell, and then I understand that there's still another amendment, or possibly more, of people that think that this is a pretty good bill and an opportunity to pile on. So we it's my understanding that they will not have all of the amendments before us today. Doris, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Doris Penwell from the Association of Oregon Counties. The last time this bill was before you, the county supported the bill as it left the committee. However, there was an amendment attached to it that delayed the implementation to 2007 because of an issue with regard to Harney County. It didn't occur to me at the time that there were some other options that might be available. So after the hearing, with Representative Butler, I contacted Steve Grasty, who's the chief judge of Harney County, to find out if we ask for an amendment to move up the implementation date for 10 of the zones, going from 4 to 10 to 2006, and dropping all of the further expansion to all of the zones, would he support that? And he said a year was perfectly good, enough time that he thought he would be able to find out whether this provision for his enterprise zone would work for them.
So, Doris, rather than going to 49 new enterprise
zones... That's right. The dash 7 only goes to 10, and that is it for now.
And starting in 2006...
That's right. Delaying
and
a year.
Let's see, this is an addition to approve no more than 10.
That's right.
So that's an additional 6 zones.
Additional 6.
Okay. And how are those zones typically selected? Now, Representative Riley knows something about this because I think this bill...
I learned it from her.
Oh, okay. All right.
Well, Mr. Chair, it is the Economic and Community Development Department administers the Enterprise Zone Program, and the e-commerce designation is an overlay of that. The department would open up opportunities for the current enterprise zones, the ones that are established, to apply for an e-commerce designation, and so there that would be competitive. I suspect if it went to 10, so that would be 6 more, they would have that many. I don't know that, but, you know, the last time it was opened up, they had many more than zones. Yes, he is. and he could answer questions much better than I can, except to say that the department makes sure that all of the qualifications are met for businesses that would come to an enterprise zone that has the overlay, and I want to remind you that the investment is on new investment. It's not anything they have now. So it wouldn't be taking away anything from what anyone is investing before they got this, they were qualified.
Are there questions of Ms. Pinwheel? Thank you very much. Let me just make sure that the legislative revenue is with us here. The amendment that you've prepared is based upon six more zones. Is that correct, Mary?
Yes.
Okay. And previously we had numbers that were brought to us from the floor, and I don't have those, that go out, and those were evidently passed out before the bill was amended, A, in gross, before it came to us, that went clear out to the year 2011, 2012. Can you tell us about that local property tax and the income tax general fund revenue issues? Again, these are back in March on the bill as it was in another committee before it arrived here.
That was just a part of the simulation. It was for illustration to show the committee the assumptions that were made relative to whether the tax credit would be taken, the property tax or the corporate income tax credit might be taken completely, you know, in the first 2 years or spread out over 5 years. And I took it out that far merely for illustration because 5 years was the limit. But basically when it came down to giving you the FY 0507 or 709, I picked up those numbers for those years specifically.
Okay.
In the past, when I've done this kind of analysis elsewhere, sometimes we've showed the total impact as if it all happened in 1 year, mm-hmm. as opposed to just the 0507, because it all depends on effective dates and whatever, right? So I wanted to give you a sense at that time of the impact over time as well as the two biennium. And that was the purpose of that, really. And I'm hoping it didn't confuse you too much. But if you look at the detailed data, it will sum up to the numbers that I carried forward to the two biennium.
Now, I come back to your assumptions, Mary, and these are assumptions on the now B7.
Right.
Under data 517. And the assumptions are that there are 14 e-commerce projects. Now, we get information there are considerably more than that in the state. These assumptions must be dated back to when the information we were given back earlier. This would have been the latter part of April.
This would be the what you're looking at here on the dash 7 estimate that gives you the increment based on your amendment for the accelerated date that gives you six more entities in 2006. Mm-hmm. This the amount that would be the number of designations. Four designated e-commerce zones. These are assumptions, correct?
Yeah, these are
assuming what would happen.
These are the assumptions, and they were based upon 14 e-commerce projects located within the four designated zones. Now we've got Representative Esquivel. You said we were up to
34
in the whole state.
In the whole state. So that number has doubled since we last met, or.
No, when the assumptions are given, we're talking the assumptions pertain to the effect of the increment, not what's existing out there right now. We have 12, you know, so many zones right now. We have so many projects.
Well, when I read the assumptions, it says currently there are 14 e-commerce projects within the four designated enterprise or electronic enterprise zones. The estimated increment exemption value of these projects is roughly $75,000 for the 0507. And $2,768 for the 0405 for e-commerce project.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Bradley.
Could we call Art up and ask get him to help us out?
Yeah, Art, do you have information on that? Maybe that would be.
Chair Butler, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Arthur Fish with the Oregon Economic and Development Department. I believe I can clarify. Staff is working with 14 as the current projects that are actually completed and have actually started to file for tax breaks based on their e-commerce investments through 05-06.
So that's 14 completed.
Now, I believe Representative Esquivel was referring to a number that grows daily, frankly, that includes proposed projects that were, you know, until at least very recently underway or just not even started yet. So that would be the discrepancy. Okay. And I believe staff is using an appropriate starting place and then multiplying it by something to square with either 6 or 49 more or whatever may be the case.
Okay.
All right.
Mr. Chair. And I just need to make sure that we are using that this is, that your estimations of yesterday are based upon these 6 additional zones. Okay.
Correct, yeah.
Representative Esquivel?
Yeah, I've always looked at this kind of like it's a great big ball that's starting downhill and it's going slower, but it's picking up and getting quicker and quicker as it goes, and the more it picks up, the more capital you have and the more job you have that are retained and or created.
Okay. The 09, 11, and 11, 12, or 11, 13 for the 5-year, and is this still a 5-year program? Is that what we're looking at? Or this continues on in perpetuity without anything else happening to it, does it not?
Chair Butler, members of the committee, the enterprise zones themselves sunset in 2009. The e-commerce aspect for some or all or whatever the case may be is essentially lasts as long as the enterprise zones do. But the actual exemptions, as you know, are only 3 to 5 years, and you know, and then you only get a credit on a one-time credit with 5 years of carry forward.
So once they're in and up and certified by the OECD, mm-hmm. and that defines the maximum amount of the credit, and then if they don't show the profits within the 5 years, then the credit goes away. The carryover credit is gone.
Chair Butler, members of the committee, that's absolutely correct. I mean, they claim an exemption. I mean, we don't do anything per se. They claim it on their return, and it is what it is for that tax year when they made the investment, and then whatever goes unused is potentially usable for the subsequent 5 years.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Hatt?
Clarify one thing, Art. Is it just 1 year on the corporate tax credit side?
Vice Chair Haas, members of the committee, that's true. I mean, it's a one-time credit based on the year you make an investment. Now, if you make further e-commerce investments while also being qualified for a property tax exemption in terms of having increased jobs and having some qualified property in the enterprise zone, then you may claim another credit on that those additional capital assets used for e-commerce. So it may be used more times, but you only get a credit for one time on any given assets, and then you can, you know, you carry forward the unused portions respectively.
And Art, as you're doing that, you're creating more jobs. It's not just more investment. Isn't it in electronic equipment that normally would have more jobs associated?
Chair Butler, members of the committee, possibly, if you're making a new investment in the enterprise zone respective to the property tax exemption, yes.
I mean, it's not job dependent.
It is at least at the first, in the sense that a business that's already in the enterprise zone has to increase its employment there by 10% in order to qualify to begin with for any of this. But you may use it a few different years without doing that again.
Okay, yeah. Follow up, Representative. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Ray. There was some concern raised about the definition of e-commerce, and I'm just wondering whether you think, given the technology advances since the original bill 4 years ago, do we also need to sort of upgrade and build a brick wall around those definitions so that, you know, somebody raised the point that anybody with it's 50, I know there's the 50% threshold.
Mm-hmm.
In this day and age of technology, even that might be something we might have to look at again.
Vice Chair Haas, Chair Butler, members of the committee. Actually, I find, you know, it's a pretty self-regulating definition. Obviously, administratively, we revisit it by rule, and the law is very clear. It gives the OECD the authority to deal with those the technical things by rule, but. If you have to be doing transactions over the internet or on a platform that uses the internet, and there isn't much else required, but you know, the assets that you can use for the credit are only those things that are involved with e-commerce or that relate to it through like order fulfillment and stuff. So a whole shipping dock, for example, that ships the product that has been ordered by over the internet could be eligible for the credit. So, I mean, that's really the key, is to understand what things really are part of that business. The 50% trigger is just the degree to which the transactions are based on the Internet as opposed to other things. I mean, we don't want to penalize a company because, yes, they still do some stuff over the phone and they still do some stuff in person, but as long as there's that Internet component, then the new stuff that goes along with that is eligible. So I think it's pretty clear where we get to when we're dealing with e-commerce and when we're not.
Well, I mean, what you just said, though, gave me, I mean, I would have been okay if you would have left out that example about the shipping dock, but I think, you know, so what, you know, a shipping dock, more space, land, real estate, you know, something, Heisters to move the products that will be available on the Internet. I mean, where does that go?
Vice Chair Haas, Representative Butler, members of the committee. The language order fulfillment is right, is in the language in ORS 307.517. You know, it was envisioned that, you know, if you want to help an e-commerce business to expand and give them a credit in the general sense, but also a tax credit as an incentive, you have to look at the totality of the business that goes along with that and is part of what you want to see happen in the enterprise zone. So, I mean, to the benefit of increasing business development, all of that has to be in the enterprise zone to be counted. And so, you know, I mean, that's the decision the legislature made, and I'm glad you brought it up if it causes you concern, but I believe it is a very good aspect of the law.
So a new warehouse or real estate could be counted?
Vice Chair Haas, Chair Butler, members of the committee, yes. I mean, if that warehouse and the shipping or the other aspects are part of what is being driven by the e-commerce, then yes. I mean, that is clearly envisioned. And, you know, I'm trying to think there's other ways to, you know, look at that. I mean, you have the Blue Cross, for example, that's using the program for a variety of stuff related just to policy maintenance and so forth. You know, there's other things that lead to those policies and that work being done there over the Internet to a great degree. We have, I don't know what Dell does in Roseburg. I don't know if they do any direct shipping from there, but that would be a positive thing. And, in fact, it would be perfectly eligible, as, you know, we've talked about, in the enterprise zone now for the property tax exemption. The question is, how much of those assets can be attributed to the 25% tax credit? And, yeah, I mean, if you have an existing building and use it for a lot of other things that don't relate to e-commerce, you know you can't use that for your credit. But if you build new stuff that is, you know, mostly serving or relating to e-commerce, then, yes, that would be part of what the credit may be based upon.
I recognize these are an overlay, and so there's two sets of tax exemptions that are involved here, or tax credits that are involved here. And Art, some of the items that we're being asked from the floor involve the enterprise zone issues and not the overlay issues. So I'm going to have a better feel for the enterprise zones before we go back to the floor with this. Mm-hmm. And then I'd like to have the benefit of the numbers that you've reviewed, Mary, and other committees that spread this tax credit out for the 5 years, and then the subsequent number of years that e-commerce zones and the enterprise zones overlays that are out there, so that so I'll have that information in my file, because if we're talking about an $80 million investment of 40 companies, that's $2 million per company, approximately, from what I'm understanding what Representative Esquivel was saying in their fair city there in Medford. So, I don't know whether that's whether there's some real property included in that. If those folks are taking a credit based upon $2 million, based upon $80 million, that $80 million could generate over the next several years the equivalent of a $20 million credit, a 25% of the investment made in e-commerce. Now, I'm not certain that the full $80 million involves e-commerce. Some portion of it obviously would, because they are e-commerce zone or e-commerce businesses in an enterprise zone. So the most important part of that is that in order to fit in that overlay, they've got to generate so many jobs, new jobs in that zone, and I think that was one of the misunderstandings we were having on the floor, was that these folks could have foreign subsidiaries that were doing business with other call centers in India. And I'm saying basically the same thing Representative Riley is saying. They're not going to take any credits on anybody that's in India. They're only going to take credits against profits they're making in the state of Oregon in the enterprise zone and the e-commerce overlay.
And they must increase their employees in the enterprise zone by 10%.
By 10%.
If they're existing.
If they're existing.
New business, whatever they bring in is what they get.
Yeah. Okay.
Chair Butler, members of the committee, if I might, just a comment on the $80 million. That is a number that I get from the property tax side based on the qualified property, in many cases, that they've only proposed that would receive the property tax exemption. On the 12 projects that staff is referencing, I have about $16 million in qualified property. How much of that really are assets that can be used vis-a-vis the credit? I don't have that kind of data. The Department of Revenue might, but as I think you've seen in the tax expenditure report, there isn't enough businesses yet after 3 or 4 years to actually claim enough to really, you know, hide who's doing it if one wanted to look at it, so they've had to keep it confidential. So I think that gives you an idea of how little of this property can be so readily used to claim credits right away. So I think you can get a gleaning from that if you look at the revenue impacts as estimated in 2001. They're much less than we've actually seen in that area. So I just bring that up.
Thank you, Art. Doris, you're presenting for our consideration in the B7, which is a total of 10 enterprise or economic development or e-commerce designations within the state, and that the effective date would be July 1st of 2006. Would be the changes that the B7.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. Just so you have an alternative to consider here.
And if I may, that returns the bill more or less to where it was when it was introduced at our request.
Right. Yeah, and I'm aware of that, Art, and I appreciate.
So we support it.
Yeah. I think there's probably ample justification for doing that. I think it still concerns me though that we're unable to attract. I know why they don't come to Harney County. We don't have any rail transportation in Harney County. Everything has to be done by truck, and the Highway 20 has been closed to heavy truck traffic. That's been a problem. So I know why they're not rushing out to Harney County right at this particular moment. My concern is, why can't we get them in Roseburg? Why can't we get them in Northwest Portland? I mean, if you're going to get them anywhere in this state, get them within 2 miles of the port, for goodness sakes. And for some reason we're unable to do that, and so I'm still anxious as to you know what causes the success in these things, and I realize too that it sometimes takes several stabs at one of these to make it work.
Chair Butler, members of the committee, if I might comment, I share your anxiety. You know, it is an interesting thing, but if I could, people make a difference. I mean, the people in Medford have done a tremendous job grasping this and using it. And I am working very closely with people in Harney County to sort of get them to, you know, really, really understand and put this out there and get that ball rolling. Because, I mean, it has to roll in different places, and it's been delayed for various reasons. Roseburg has had some success. Portland is using it. Again, if you look at the northeast Portland parts, they're not necessarily prime e-commerce type areas. And, you know, and Portland has its own little conditions that go with their enterprise zone that apply to. So there are a variety of reasons which I'd love to share with you.
Well, I'm comfortable that once Highway 20 is up and running, that we'll be able to get heavy trucks back and forth. And 395 between the freeways up north and California down south, 395 is open. I think that as you work with my colleagues from Harney County, they're working on a lot of that fiber optic cable issue anyway, and bringing the right kinds of people in. I'm anxious that we get something done there, because that'd be a great place. I mean, the beautiful thing about e-commerce is that no matter where in the world you're at, you're only 1/8 of a second maximum away from your competition.
The highways don't matter.
No, they really don't. So I'm really anxious that we were able to do something there. So, colleagues, thank you very much. Any further question of this panel? We'll take the D7 under advisement. This is a work session. And I understand that there are more adjustments yet to come and be proposed by other folks who would like to try and see if we can't enhance this. So with that, we'll hold this over.
There is a B6, if you want to look at it.
There is a B6, and,
right.
And what does it do?
It just is the B and growth bill with an additional clarifying, some additional requests for clarifying language provided by the Department of Revenue. It has no incremental impact. So I had no impact up at the top of the SMS, but actually it would be the same impact as the B and growth bill. But the incremental impact of these two clarifying clauses would have no impact.
Okay. Let's take that up when we see the rest of them, and then we'll be able to decide which ones, if any. And colleagues, if session shuts down and this is still on our desk, then I guess Burns has got a better shot along with Medford anyway. But with that, we will continue to work this in earnest and see if we can't get all of the amendments before us. Thank you very much. With that, we will close the work session on House Bill 2234 and we'll close revenue for today.